Hey y'all, it's Jessie.
Hi, it's Helen here.
And you're listening to another episode of Asian Bitches Down Under. Hey guys, how's it going, Helen?
Yeah, I'm doing well. Yourself?
I'm struggling with back pain, struggling with being my 30s now.
Goodness.
It's a process of learning and being patient with yourself. I think that's what I'm discovering year by year as I head into my 30s. Mm-hmm. Just being okay with the fact that my body no longer heals as quickly as it used to.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like I did some yoga the other week and then I must have just strained something. And then like I literally have not been able to move my lower back for a couple of days.
Ouch.
And you know, going to the physio is so expensive, right?
Yeah, it is.
I mean, it's fucking awesome. I fucking love my physio, Steve, like really gets in there and it's so vital what they do. But man, you need to be rich to access. Like I was just thinking, if I was in the States, I would not be able to afford. Like it's more than $100 every time I see him.
Yeah, I know. It's expensive.
It's just these things we take for granted. I know. It's
your
crazy.
Body,
it's
especially the body.
Exactly. Yeah. Anything to do with the body, I just think healthcare, all those ugly, boring things that we never think about, you know?
When you're younger.
Yeah exactly. Gosh. Yeah. When I was in my 20s, I was being bashed around on the frisbee field day in, day out. Like I would literally fall on my knees and it'll be violent. But like literally the next day I would be okay.
Yeah. I think.
Like did you feel once you hit 30 that your body just no longer recovered as quickly?
Yeah. I think I've been saying like almost more often now than before or ever that I hate being old. Like I
actually love being older. Really?
Yeah.
I love. Well, like I definitely don't. I don't love the fact that my body takes much longer to recover, but I do love the things that I'm noticing getting older.
Oh yeah, an experience.
I love that. Yeah. No, it's just being patient with oneself and just learning that there are some things that are so fulfilling that you do not like. It's almost like the year by year as I get older, and whenever I say this to people, they're like, "Oh fucking hell, you're still in your early 30s." Like fuck you. But like what I mean is like when I mean is like year by year I discover things like I almost feel like there are spectrums of my selfhood that I did not even think was possible when I was in my 20s. And if I had told my 20-year-old self about these things, she would not have even tried to listen to me.
Yeah, she would tell you to fuck off.
You know? Yeah, exactly. She would say the only thing that matters is getting a lot of sex with men and, I don't know, like looking good. You know, all these parameters that we have for a fulfilling life are so different in your 30s.
Right.
And I love growing into that wisdom, you know.
It's not the physical feeling that we're encountering now, as in our body's not taking up as much. Yeah, I can understand.
Yeah, like you had a bit of back pain a few weeks
ago,
right?
Yeah, I did. It was from yoga as well. It's just so strange, I think.
Really? Yeah.
Because during this period, you know, with the pandemics, everyone's like pretty much cooped up in their own houses and you just have to find something to do.
Yeah,
I think
exactly.
A lot of people has turned to yoga. I mean, for me, I never really liked yoga, but I think it really kind of pushed my body to the max to the physical exercise. Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of yoga, I went on a yoga date with a guy last night. So he invited me. It was a first date.
Okay.
And I feel still a bit upset about it because here's what happened. I feel hurt by it. So he told me that he was going to book a class in for me, which I thought, great, awesome. Mm-hmm. It was on the other side of the bridge, so in Chatswood.
Oh, okay.
And so it's completely not my scene. You know, it's so different. The demographic, I would say, Chatswood people are just as rich as like inner West Sydney people, but they're just very different, right?
Yes.
And I went there and I thought it was nice that I just thought it was a great way to meet someone, you know, because I love yoga so much. And then I discovered when I got there that he had also invited his neighbor.
Oh, okay.
And this neighbor was this like young, hot girl. She was so hot. And then she ended up coming to dinner with us as well.
Okay. So did he set the...
Like, what the fuck?
Did he set the perimeter properly, as in, like, is it only a date between you two? Or did he tell...
Yeah, he didn't tell me that the neighbor was also coming to the dinner. And so I felt like, even though it was very, like, you know how I'm approaching dating now. It's like, you know, very lighthearted. Mm-hmm. I didn't actually mind that she was coming to yoga with us or the dinner, but I would have appreciated
that he told you before.
Yeah, I know.
I think it's a courtesy that he's supposed to have.
I know. Yeah. And it's a first date as well.
And you never know whether or not he was just trying to get that girl out of her house. Do you understand what I mean? Yeah. Like, sometimes I know that there are guys or girls that's trying to, I don't want to use the word manipulate, but yeah, utilize someone else, saying that, oh yeah, it's going to be like a group scene, trying to receive more attentions, from that individual person.
Attention. Exactly. Yeah. I almost felt like, I mean, he was very friendly and this dude was like, he was not a dick at all. The way they interacted was, it was clear that they had something going on, that they were friendly in a way that wasn't completely platonic. Mm-hmm. And during the dinner, she was actually more interesting than he, as often is the case. Whenever I mingle with people, I often find that I'm more attracted, not sexually, but more, I found that the women are more appealing.
Yes.
But I still felt a bit injured by the end of it, and I'm still recovering from it this morning, because I was like, I don't know why I feel hurt, because like, I don't know this man, I don't have feelings for him, but I'm still trying to process the reason why I'm hurt. And I think it's because he used me under the pretext of like a date in order to fulfill his own whatever. Maybe he was fucking her, who knows, but it still felt like I was being used somehow, you know? And that, I think, is why I'm a bit hurt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can understand that. Yeah, he's at the fault of not doing, you know, having the courtesy of at least letting you know beforehand that it's actually going to be like a three people date.
Which I wouldn't have mind if he told me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just like the expectation and the disappointment afterwards.
I mean, I wasn't, I wasn't expecting sex from him, because I don't want to have sex with any stranger on the first date. That's not me. You know how I feel about sex now. I could be celibate. I'm very happy to be celibate for the rest of my life. But it's still hurtful. Yeah. It still felt hurtful, which I'm surprised at myself. I thought that I wouldn't so easily be hurt. But maybe I'm more sensitive than I care to admit.
It's always hard to know.
On another note, what did you get up to this week?
Okay, so I eventually finished Bernadine Evaristo's book, Dear Woman and Other. I think I mentioned it before that her unique style of writing, it's something that I think it's possibly going to become a bit more mainstream in the future.
Cool, okay.
I mean, I just feel like that she's not following a very constrictive style of writing. You know, the words have flowed out so easily when you read them. And I felt quite connected with this book in the sense that the stories include culture clash, you know, mother-daughter relationship and the essentially emotional roller coasters for Black and people of color in Western nation. What I would advise for people who want to read this book is that try to complete the reading in a short time, because I took quite long, I think over 3 weeks to finish this book. And because there's multiple characters in the story, like in the book, and they have intertwined or overlap stories that you need to remember from the very beginning of the book that the character will appear later in the book. And I really enjoy reading this book as it portrays, you know, stories of characters from very different backgrounds, you know, the intersectionality, being a woman with conservative backgrounds, woman with adventuring out their sexuality, and also there's trans people in the book as well.
Yeah, great.
And how they struggle within the society, how they struggle with their family. I want to actually extend the discussion of her book with a connection of a webinar that I've attended yesterday.
Yeah, cool.
It's going to be kind of a long rant of myself, but the webinar is actually conducted by University of Sydney's business faculty. I was invited as an alumni. And the topic was around leadership during pandemic. One of the experts on the panel, I think her name was Katrina Wallace, and she's an advisor on the ethical issue of around AI, artificial intelligence. Yeah. And she commented how AI would pretty much replace a lot of our current work.
Yeah.
Right, by using the past and historical data and algorithm to process and produce the work, you know, for humans. But she said there's a flaw in the historical data, which she also mentioned the book Invisible Woman. You know how a lot of historical data is actually quite flawed and biased and prejudiced.
Yeah, and sexist. Everything.
Of course, and racist. Yeah. Everything. Yeah.
Yeah.
And what I'm thinking that perhaps the creativities from, like, for example, that used to be non-mainstream. For example, you know, like Black, Indigenous, people of color, LGBTQI groups, and all other minorities. The group in the minorities, creativity will be a bit more valued because we are currently. Perhaps I'm just guessing, you know, I'm taking like a leap of guessing by saying that because our mind and our brain cannot be replaced by AI at the moment because there's not enough data in the past. Yeah. And hopefully that it will become a bit more popularized. Yeah. In saying that, there's actually, can you believe it? Like there's a op-ed that's written by an AI called GPT-3. That was published in The Guardian this week. You can just, when you read it, you're kind of scared by it because you often think that opinion editorial is written by a human that's got a processed mind and a certain level of intelligence. And now you're reading a piece of article that's written by AI. Okay, what else that will be possible to be replaced by artificial intelligence in the very near future?
Yeah, totally. One of my ex-boyfriends, he was obsessed with AI. And a few years ago when I was working on Lonely Girl, he told me that he was really intrigued by the idea that in a few years' time, AI computers will be able to write fiction novels. And apparently they already have. They already have. Like, and people can't tell the difference between a robot and a human writing a book, he was really excited about that prospect. But I remember thinking, I'm not interested in that. I'm not interested in replacing robots, replacing writers with robots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I understand robots replacing other human resources, but not when it comes to the arts.
Yeah, of course.
I'm not going to say creativity. I'm just going to say the arts. How interesting. That sounds like an excellent webinar.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. And like when she mentioned Invisible Woman, like it kind of reminded me that I have to go on and read that book.
Yeah, everyone has to read that book. I mean, I haven't read it, but we often talk about how important it is for us to go.
Definitely. Yeah, and I think that the structure around culture discussions, I think that's going to be it's going to be ever-changing. You know, you can't really have an AI to be involved without experience. I mean, you can have the data and algorithm within an AI, but how much that, you know, an AI can produce, you know. Yeah, I mean, I never know, of course, until it happens.
Yeah. Let's take a bit of a break before we move on to the cultural consumptions we took this week. We'll be right back, guys. So welcome back to Asian Bitches Down Under. This week, you know how Billy and I, we're going through the witches kind of theme of the 90s, 80s and 90s. So this week we saw The Witches of Eastwick. Have you heard of that film?
No, I haven't.
I hadn't heard about it, but I've heard of the film, but I've never seen it. It's starring massive, massive Hollywood superstars, Jack Nicholson, Cher, Susan Sarandon and Michelle Pfeiffer. It was a film based on John Updike's novel of the same name. And the novel, I believe, was published in 1984. And we're trying to read it now. We've started a book club together. And the film was filmed in 1987, so the year I was born. And it was so fucking weird. It's so weird. That's all I have to say about that. Seriously, that's all I have to say about that. It's about these three women who are divorcees and they conjure up a man and then this man turns out to be some like Trumpian, wild, weird beast. For all you listeners out there, probably don't watch it. I wouldn't recommend watching it because after we watched it, we were like, that was fucking weird. But I'm going to read the book now and I guess I will circle back and tell you how the book is. I've never read any John Updike. So it'll be interesting.
Do you think it was appropriate? Maybe was it set in the 80s?
Yeah, 1987.
Okay.
Oh, the book is apparently set in the 60s.
Oh,
but the film was set in the 80s, so it's interesting. But Michelle Pfeiffer, far out, she is absolutely stunning when she's young. Yeah, just absolutely stunning.
Yeah.
And there's a great scene where Susan Sarandon, she's a cellist, and a music teacher in the film. And there's a great scene where she She's playing the Dvorak cello concerto. She's going wild. Uh-huh. And then she kind of starts feeling like Jack Nicholson comes over with a fiddle and he plays for her. And they start, like, there's sexual tension that builds up. And at one point she plays this climactic phrase in the Dvorak.
Uh-huh.
I believe it was the first movement of the Dvorak cello concerto.
Mm-hmm.
If you haven't heard it, guys, it is the best cello. It is the best concerto, I think. Yeah, and there's one scene where she kind of gets turned on by him, and then she throws her cello off the floor, off herself, and then the cello just like starts, erupts into flame. What? It's so funny, that scene. Yeah, it just erupts into flame. It's like that scene, you know that scene in The Simpsons where Homer's making breakfast for Mr. Burns,
uh-huh.
and then he burns everything up, everything he does.
And then he
pours cereal into the milk into the cereal, and then it erupts. Yeah, to say it's like that.
Okay, that is weird.
Yeah, I love that scene. But anyway, Helen, what did you consume?
Apart from Everest, though, I haven't really watched much this week. Kind of been following one of the social debate in Taiwan. Because last week there was a massive social news that came out of a woman who committed suicide, which, you know, you don't really happen to see in a lot of Western medias because we don't tend to report, you know, suicidal news. When erupted in like a social media in Taiwan is because that she left a note saying that my mother-in-law killed me.
What the hell?
So it kind of opened up a whole conversation about the complicated situation between daughter-in-law and mother-in-law in Taiwan.
Which is so fucked up, can I just tell listeners?
Yeah, it is.
It is so, so fucked.
Yeah, you know, the continuation of perpetuated, you know, of power dynamics and intergenerational issues from my experience, I can only talk about like Taiwan background. Perhaps it happens in all other, you know, countries with a very conservative and traditional family values. I think because generally that in Taiwan, when you're married, you're considered to be married into your husband's family.
That's right.
And it has been a lot of problems, and I've heard a lot of issues between daughter-in-law and mother-in-law, that because they have to be, they need to live together, you know, some kind of filial POD kind of shit value that they continue to have. So often that the daughter-in-law end up, you know, like serving the mother-in-law.
The mother-in-law, yeah, like a slave, literally a slave. I'm not joking. I'm not joking at all.
It kind of remind me of one of the news that happened in China last year. A woman died when she was giving birth because her husband's family refused to sign the paper for her to go into C-section. The mother-in-law insisted her of having a natural birth.
Oh my God.
So it was such a tragic.
That is so fucked.
Yeah, it was so
fucked. What the fuck? We live in such a fucked up world. I just don't understand it. I do not understand it.
So what happened with this news was that
the
news in Taiwan is that people starting to, you know, dig up, you know, what happened with this woman, how she was she like having mental illness? Was it really that she was being pressured by her mother-in-law? So people found out what happened was that she had a great job. Like she had a great career path and she's got kids herself. Mm-hmm. And she married into like a very like reasonable wealthy family. And apparently that her husband was having an affair, but the mother-in-law was covering it for the son and saying that, oh, it's because it's like she's literally blaming the daughter-in-law.
Blaming the wife.
Saying that because you're not satisfying him. That's why he's going out his way to find another woman. Picking up all sort of fights, you know. I just don't understand why women would going down that path of deliberating conflict with another woman. You know, it feels really bad for me seeing stories like this. Just picking up issues from about her daily life, you know, complaining about how she is failing to parent her kids and just bits and pieces. I think that's probably pushed her over the cliff and, you know, took her own life, which is really sad.
I think what we often don't know here in the West is that there's an incredible amount of pressure and a lot of historical baggage, which is so inseparable. When you are, when you do become a wife in places like Taiwan, you're really joining a very long line of women in history who, once you become a mother, once you become a wife, you are part of this cohort and you are obliged. There's a very much standardized obligation in which you are, you become very much a slave to your husband's mother, and you follow not just your husband's rules, but almost, it's almost like your husband's mother has even more, takes on a grander importance than your own husband, because your husband, being a man and an Asian man in the Asian society, is filled with so much responsibility and duty, and what comes with that duty and that responsibility is the sense that he owes his whole life to his mother, and for the rest of his life as an adult, he needs to really do as much as he possibly can to satisfy his mother. There is no making your mother unhappy, and what the wife needs to do once she becomes married into that family is she becomes part of that obligation to fulfill any desires that the mother has. It's almost like in the East, what I find is that you become a wife and you struggle for about 40 years becoming a wife, and once you have your son, you get to then boss around your son's wife because you had suffered for so many years, and you feel like you are now in a position at the age of 60, 70 years old to demand that you are respected because you have gone through all that suffering with your own mother-in-law.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's just like a cycle of fucking abuse.
Exactly. I agree. It's a cycle. It's absolutely a cycle. And I don't know how that's going to be broken, because feminism, in the way that it's evolved here in the West, has not evolved in the East.
Mm-hmm. Not enough.
At least not, not in the mainstream way. It hasn't leaked out into the mainstream populace.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I really don't see how that will change. What do you think about that?
I am seeing like older generations, but very, very few feminists that's starting to change around the values, you know, surrounding family and society. But I think it's just not enough. People avoid talking about it. I mean, I think it's also down to economical impact as well. One of the lawyer who was commenting on this news, he said that the only solution is that don't ever live together with your in-laws.
Yeah.
But a lot of people don't get that option.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Exactly.
But I think if you don't get that option, fucking don't get married.
It's not that easy. A lot of women are required to get married. It's not a choice for them in this world.
Oh, fuck.
That's something we often don't remember when we're talking about marriage. It's often under the guise of liberation and choice here in the West. But marriage is an obligation that is enforced upon women in other countries. In most other countries, in fact, outside of the West. It's not a choice at all.
Yeah.
So we should never forget that.
Yeah.
So let's take a break before we launch into our main segment for this week.
Yay.
We'll be right back, guys. Oh, welcome back, guys. So this week we wanted to talk about this thing that both Helen and I have been intrigued for a long time. For me, it's something that I've never sat down to explicitly interrogate, this idea of sexual empowerment and what it means.
Mm-hmm.
So a few weeks ago, we're approached by a woman who runs a business selling lingeries, and Helen and I started thinking about why neither of us wear lingerie, because I don't, I think Helen and I started asking all my friends, and all my friends were like, we only buy, like, the most expensive lingerie I've ever bought is from, like, Bonds.
I actually once bought Calvin Klein lingerie when I was like 24 because I was like, what's the whole fuss with good lingerie? And then I bought it and it was like $100 for the entire set, like top and bottom. And it was very, it wasn't sexy. Like I've never actually bought sexy lingerie. Calvin Klein is quite minimalist, you know. And I bought it thinking it might make me feel like a real woman because I had just started a full-time job at 24. And it did not change my relationship to my body at all, and I, like, the last bra I bought was, like, 3 years ago from Kmart. Like, I'm just so, you know how Helen and I started talking about, like, what makes us feel sexy? Because we were like, well, maybe people buy lingerie to feel sexy, right? But I have never felt like when I wanted to feel sexy with a partner, I just fucking get undressed. Like I'm naked. I think for me, nakedness is sexy. Yeah. What about you? What were you thinking?
Okay. What I was thinking is that on the term sexual empowerment, like I want to separate sex and empowerment first, you know, like empowerment for me is being the idea of confident enough that I don't care the judgment of others and just to be myself, but at the same time, you know, not really eroding the values that I have, for example, you know, moral, ethical values. As I consider that I'm pretty progressive person, and of course there are things that perhaps that I'm not aware or informed enough to engage, to understand yet. Empowerment for me means that I can take control of what I do and at the same time understand the consequences of my choice. I think the main part of empowerment is the consequences, you know, not like, I guess it's probably different for everyone. And it's definitely give and take in everything. As in for empowerment for us here today, you know, to construct identities around sexual empowerment and how we're representing ourselves for others.
Yeah, exactly.
Through the lens of own ourselves, not, you know, the others.
Yeah.
Yeah, in saying that, you know, sexual empowerment for me is knowing when to say yes and when to say no.
Totally.
The idea around consent, you know, first and most important, I think. I guess a lot of people gets down to start thinking about confidence and their body and whether or not they're okay to showing it off and not afraid to step out of their mainstream ideas of, you know, sexual beauty standards and all that. Partly for me is like you understand your own libidos, you know, and your own intuition about your body and when you want or not want to have sex. Of course, down to the choices of by myself, not the other people, and not obviously not what the social expectation. In saying that, I think this includes, you know, the choice of using sex toys and how individual chooses to pleasure themselves, and also setting boundaries with your sexual partner. You know, some people are fine with having multiple sexual partners, but others are not.
A lot of my friends are. It's so normal. I have the most vanilla sex life.
Vanilla.
I'm so vanilla when it comes to sex.
I think we'll be talking about, we mentioned that we want to do a pod about the monogamy, didn't we?
Polyamory.
That's the term.
Yeah, we'll do another pod on that once I like do a couple of workshops and interview a few people. Yeah, but it's a massive issue. Yeah, do you want to finish your thoughts and then I'll jump in?
Yeah, okay. So I guess it's really down to very basic, like for the fundamental ideas about body autonomy, you know, how we teach kids and how we extend it to our sexual life and sexual relation in our adulthood.
Yeah. I love everything you've said. And my own feelings overlap with a lot of what you've said. So when I sat down to think about what the idea of sexual empowerment means for me, I think, like you said, it means being able to express my own sexuality. And this is the second part that's the most important, on my own terms. That is what's really the crux of what I feel empowerment means as a woman, on my own terms, because often our sexual experiences are not on our own terms. Often it's on the terms of the man who's, like, if you're a hetero woman, you're having straight sex with a man, it's often the man who ends up dictating what goes on and the man who decides when the sex stops, because, you know, it stops when he comes. Sexual empowerment for me means to have power over my own decisions, over my own body.
Yes.
Like you said.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And having expectations of sexual pleasure in a way that makes me feel comfortable and nourishing and nourishing. Nourishing and mm-hmm. nurturing.
That's right. Yes.
So many of my sexual experiences have felt either coercive or unpleasant or strained or awkward or forced. Not forced by the man, not forced as in I don't think I've ever been raped. I'm still struggling to find the words to explain what had happened in my previous abusive relationship. But what I mean by forced, as in forced by my own need and my own compulsion to feel
mm-hmm.
accepted and loved. And in our society, mm-hmm. the way to cure loneliness or the idea that you're not loved is by having sex.
Mm-hmm.
That is probably one of the first things we all reach for. And, you know, sexual empowerment, this idea would mean something very different if you're a disabled person, for instance. Mm-hmm. Cis people have it so much easier. People who've been abused have it much harder. There's a lot of trauma to unfurl and heal the wound. Mm-hmm. And because sexual trauma has this shameful component of it to it, there's that added layer of your own shame. You feel you can't talk about it with people. And I think the reason why cis straight white men don't talk about feeling sexually empowered, you know, you never hear about a man usually saying, oh, I feel empowered sexually. It's because they tended not to have been within the groups of people who've had their sexual bodies exploited. You know,
mm-hmm.
usually it's the marginalized groups who have fallen prey to perpetrators. And these perpetrators have been historically men. Now, obviously, I'm not saying that men are not victims of sexual exploitation. Like, you know, a lot of unfortunate men, a lot of victims of, you know, clerical sexual abuse have been men. So definitely I'm not saying that mm-hmm. they're excluded. I'm just saying, like, men don't talk about feeling sexy, and that's interesting. Because there's not a large distance between their outcome and their desires. Like if a man wants sex, they call it being horny, which means that they have this desire that needs to be fulfilled. And because we live in a world built around men's desires, men have controlled the world. Men have ensured that when a man wants sex, he usually gets it pretty quickly without obstacles. Now, here I'm talking about straight cis men, obviously. Gay men have more barriers to jump through. So in Australia, obviously, they're less inhibited. But in places like Bulgaria, for instance, and a lot of other conservative societies, they still have to hide their desires and be sexually satisfied only in places like public toilets. Like Garth Greenwell writes a lot about this in his two books. And for any woman or person of colour or disabled person or non-binary person or trans person or any other marginalised group, there's a huge gap between this desire and this outcome. We need to fight harder to reach further and jump through more obstacles to close that gap between our desires and our outcomes. You know, like I want to have sex with a safe, loving, generous, warm, kind-hearted, gentle, non-pushy, unselfish man. Someone who will respect my decision to wait, you know, even if I want to wait 5 years or whatever, that shouldn't matter.
Yes.
You know? And I guess what I'm saying is that historically, marginalized people have been more vulnerable to what to have their sexuality or their sexual desires exploited or used or manipulated by those whom hold higher sexual power and higher sexual capital. And in this world, it's the cis straight white people. And because of that, we've had cumulatively suffered more at the hands of those people who hold more cachet, more sexual power. Because in this world, to hold more sexual capital for a woman is intrinsically detrimental in a way that it's not necessarily for a man. So what I mean is that, so I know a couple of barristers. One of them is a very good-looking straight white male. He's very charming. And when he's in the courtroom and in his professional life, even though he's charming and obviously like sexually attractive, he's still taken very seriously in the courtroom and in his profession. Whereas I know this extremely attractive barrister female friend of mine, and she often gets treated differently around the chambers. Like even though she's just as smart and charismatic and as this straight white guy, she is often like when people refer to her in the offices, you see the tenor in which people talk about her. And it's like she is the hot barrister. People refer to her as that hot woman because it's so rare to have a hot female barrister. And so, so it's almost like her beauty has become this distracting thing that diminishes her credibility.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's hard for her to be taken seriously. And I just think about that when it comes to how a woman can perform sexual empowerment and where she's able to explore and project that on her own terms.
Mm-hmm. I love everything that you just said, especially on the part where you talked about nourishing. That's right, you know. I think it needs to happen on the level, both on physical, you know, the intimacy between the bodies and also emotionally as well, which absolutely. I think a lot of people fail to really understand that.
I agree.
It needs to be on emotional levels as well as the physical level.
Yeah.
And by saying that, you know, in the comparison of cis male and, you know, and females, how the society is particularly very sexist, you know, everywhere almost, you know, you see that woman, you know, what I'm talking about, just straight woman mm-hmm. being objectified, firstly of their physical appearance before anything else, you know, before her intelligence, before her emotional levels, before basically you just put, you know, her sexuality as a physical being, you know, objectified at first rather than considering anything else. I've got a quote here from the sex therapist Jenna Brito in Hawaii. You know, I think it's really important here that she mentioned a couple of key characteristics of sexual empowerment. She said that things like feeling free to express your own sexual interest, feeling comfortable in your own body, feeling confident saying yes and no, also prioritizing your safety over the need to please others.
I love that. I just want to say I had a sexual relationship with this guy who I was in love with so many years ago, and I found it hard to say no to him when we were in bed. Whenever he asked for something, I would always say yes because I felt so scared that if I said no, he wouldn't like me. How fucked up is that? I am so ashamed of myself.
I think it goes around the question between sexual empowerment versus sexual freedom and sexual validation. You know, like sex, sex appeal for you, as in, you know, are you doing it for yourself or are you doing it through the lens of your partner?
Yeah, and wanting to be loved.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? That's the thing. Like I was in my 20s, I was so desperate to be loved by this man that he just did really awful things to me. Like, I'm not saying he raped me, but just so awful that I felt embarrassed now thinking it back and thinking I wasn't brave enough to say to him, can you not do this? Mm-hmm. It's making me uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Like, what the fuck? I feel so ashamed that I wasn't strong enough to say, hey, can you not do this to me? I feel so bad.
Do you think you have the strength to do it now? Refusing?
Let's hope so. I think I do. I still feel like I've been celibate for so long now, like a few years. And I feel like I don't know how I will respond, to be honest. I feel that at least when I was having sex a few years ago, I felt that I was able to say no to the men I didn't actually love easier. Mm-hmm. Like, I was able to say no to guys I was seeing casually because I didn't like them. Whereas the men I really liked, I found it hard to say no to them because I wanted them to like me back.
Mm-hmm.
That's so fucked up.
I think it goes with the idea of social desirabilities, you know, like how we're kind of bombarded with a lot of messages in the media, you know, like sometimes it could confuse us of what actual empowerment
exactly
looks like.
For a woman. Exactly.
That's right. Exactly. You know, we're kind of conflated sexual liberation with sexual ability, which is, I think it's a bit dangerous because I'm just reading an article earlier this week thinking empowerment could be a lot of sex, but I think the important is that you get to choose. The power is, you know, you hold the power I think, of course, there's always a power struggle, power dynamic between two parties or multiple parties when it comes to sex.
When it comes to anything, power is political and power is intrinsically linked to every aspect of our lives. And I love our discussion today because sex is something where we haven't managed to talk about the power dynamics as a whole society in a very constructive way, in a very in a way that seeks to explain the realities of what we all face and our different metrics of sexual capital.
In saying sexual capital, you know, we're talking about the currency between individuals. Yeah. And when we're discussing about like social desirability, I think the media have a lot to say about, you know, pretty much the proximity to certain standards. Like for us, for what I've known is that it's usually like the white, whether or not that you're thin enough or you're wealthy enough, those are pretty much in the Asian standards, you know, gao fu bai. I think you need to be tall, you need to be wealthy, you need to be
pale,
white enough, pale enough to holding those currencies against who doesn't have those, that you have the power over them to demand sex.
Absolutely. Yeah. And to be the one who calls the shots, so to speak, right?
Yeah.
Helen, I want to know, are you a sexual person? And you can interpret that however you want.
I was going to ask you back, like, how do you define as a sexual person? Is it?
How would you define it? If someone just asked you, are you a sexual person, how would you answer that question?
In regarding having a lot of sex all the time? I honestly have no idea how to answer in without knowing the definition of the person who's asking me. But I think that I enjoy sex, okay? And I like the power that I have with my partner of when we have sex. I don't know how much privacy I need to go get into this, but I think I've got to get into the like age of having sex not in the same way as I was when I was younger. That's what I think, because I don't think the quantity really matters. I think quality is more important for me.
And aren't you like reaching your, Helen's in her.
I'm almost 40.
And isn't that like the peak of a woman's, apparently, according to the fucking scientists, isn't that like when a woman reaches her sexual peak? Or I don't know. I'm just asking you because it's like the stuff I've heard, but I have to say, I don't believe that. I believe that I could, like, if I'm 78 and having amazing sex, I think that is actually entirely possible. I'm not going to let science and history dictate how I engage with my body, you know? Fuck that.
I also doubt about, like, whoever who is the scientist.
Made up those, exactly.
Who did the study. They're all men. And all that. Yeah, honestly. I think should we listen to... I mean, of course, they have scientific evidence and backgrounds as well. But as the years progress, you know, everything changes about our mentality, our intelligence, how we feel about ourselves. It's not necessary that when you reach your 40s or, you know, that you're supposed to have your sexual peak. I mean, that framework is kind of like putting into the brains of all the women, and it's like the society expects you that you should be sexually active or highly active during this period of time.
Yeah.
Which I think is really bullshit, because, you know, you can have your peak sexual activity during your 20s, 30s.
70s.
Your 70s, And also, I think it's really down to individual,
I don't think I'm the sexual person I used to be. When I tell my friends about how long I've been celibate, all of them are like, what the fuck? Like, they're all so shocked. And I'm like, it doesn't mean... It's almost like... Like, when I tell them last time I had sex, it's almost like I've told them I'm still a virgin. That's how they respond. I'm like, for me, not having had sex in years is as boring and unremarkable and unnoteworthy as if I said to you, Helen, I haven't had... dumplings. No, actually, that would be bad. Dumplings. Okay, it's just like me saying I haven't gone ice skating for 2 years. It's like, for me, it doesn't, it's so monumentally irrelevant.
Yes.
Like, to have sex, like, I don't understand our whole craze around, like,
about sex and,
like, maybe
being a virgin.
I don't know.
Yeah.
About sex. Yeah. Like, I wonder if I, like, say if I'm 55 and I tell my friends I haven't had sex in 2 years, I wonder whether they will respond as crazily as they do now. Like, I wonder if they think that's crazy because I'm kind of still kind of young. But I'm so viscerally disinterested in sex. Like, I think if I, like, I still, you know, like, touch myself and things. I'm still a sexual person in that I still want to pleasure myself. And I don't mind that. But, like, when it comes to engaging with a man, I haven't felt sexually horny or desirous towards a man for years. And I'm just like, for me, it's almost like, yeah, it's like you seeking out, you know, I don't know, just this arbitrary, meaningless, irrelevant thing that has, for me, it's so not part of my daily existence, you know, intercourse.
I agree with you that I hate how the society's framework around that when you reach a certain age, you need to be popped. You know how in high school, we see all these teenage movies that...
Yeah, losing their virginity.
Yeah, losing their virginity and... Yeah. Take it as a big deal, it's like a pathway to adulthood. I think it's just really bullshit. Like, what makes people think that if you become a if you're not a virgin anymore, you're an adult? Like, you're a very immature person if don't really consider all aspects of how sex impacts your life, and you just take it for granted. Just like, yeah, I've done it, and that's it. It's like, yeah, I smoke a cigarette. I'm an adult now. You know, I think sex education is very, very important. I think you've seen, I don't know if you've seen one of the posts I've shared on my Facebook yesterday about how Australia Education Department, they want to kind of put more sex educations in schools. And I say, like, my comment is that, you know, fuck to those parents who say no to this, you know, because I know that out there's a lot of conservative parents that refuse to talk about sex education in their own household, and they refuse the school to teach their kids about sex education.
Yeah.
I mean, they think that, okay, if I don't teach them, they wouldn't do it. No, okay? For fuck's sake, it's an internet era, okay? And even without internet, with our own selves, like back in the 90s.
Yeah.
You get it from your friends, which is, you know, so often is misguided or misinterpreted.
Yeah, totally. So I remember when I masturbated as a young child, I felt like a deep sense of shame. I thought that, like, I remember being a very sexual kid as a very young kid. And I remember whenever I orgasmed, I would feel, like, disgusted with myself. And then it was only when I was, like, 8 or 9, I read Dolly. You know, Dolly used to have this sealed section. And then that was the first. Yeah, Dr. Dolly. And it was the first time I came across the word masturbate. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Dolly told me that what I was doing, there was nothing shameful about it. So fucking thank you, Dr. Dolly, for getting rid of my shame that I enjoyed taking pleasure in my own body as a young girl.
Mm-hmm. I think because we grew up with such a conservative values around sex that we haven't been taught about, and that we've spoke in our previous episodes about, you know, our dad. Family.
Yeah, dad would like go apeshit crazy whenever a kissing scene happened on a movie, as though like a mouth-to-mouth action between a man and a woman was the most repulsive thing that he didn't want us to look at.
Yeah, I think the lack of discussion of, you know, Asian sexuality is pretty much like, it's quite damaging. I think it's quite damaging for the young people that are not taught properly about sex, and not just on the biological sense. I think a lot of things that are missing in, you know, in education as we're growing up is that the emotional level about sex that is often not really talked about.
And it's so hard to talk about, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when I was growing up, I was reading Cleo, and I also was reading Cosmopolitan as well. Of course, there's still sections about sex. So that's where I got my sexual education from. And also, I've grown up with, for those people who are, like, for our listeners who are about the same age as me and with Asian backgrounds, I don't know if you know, there's a magazine published in Hong Kong. It's called Yes. Mm. I often get this from, like, bookstores in Chinatown. Right. Like, during the 90s. And
I didn't know that. Cool.
Yeah, the sex education section is called Miss Sex. Uh-huh. It's similar to Cosmo, Cleo and Dolly, you know. It's pretty much opened up the dialogue for, you know, the readers of the magazine that can write in and ask questions, even though that they think it's really ridiculous. But Miss Sex, which is this section in the magazine, you know, she will go through it in the way that's doesn't sound embarrassing or ashamed. You know, as Asians, that we're pretty much grown up telling us, family or elderly is telling us, you know, sex is shameful, you don't talk about it. And when we have the pleasure of having sex, that we question ourselves whether or not, is this shameful? Should I be feeling like this? You know, and that we can't really fully enjoy sex. Like, there's always a barrier because of what we've been taught.
Yeah. I remember when I was a kid, like, after I would orgasm, I would feel like this whole body rush of disgust, as though I had done something wrong, as though I had taken something that was evil and consumed it. Like, it was this feeling of, like what you said, like in Asian culture, to be a hedonist, to take pleasure in your own pleasure, is seen as deeply, deeply wrong and deeply immoral. Like, if you did something for your own pleasure, you're supposed to feel guilty. And I think that's what I felt. Like, I felt that whenever I orgasmed, and it was such a pleasurable, you know, orgasms are great, you know, like 5 seconds of sheer kind of bliss, like nothing else, right? It's a physical bliss. But the Asian societies have a very complex relationship, almost like a very intolerant relationship to this idea of hedonism, and, you know, it's seen, like I said before, shameful to take pleasure in your own pleasures, especially bodily pleasures, because, you know, like, across all societies, across a lot of societies, because most societies are patriarchal, we have been, as women, been given this idea that a woman's sexual capacity is a dangerous thing. You know, like, if every society in history has made attempts to control a woman's sexuality, because there is nothing more dangerous than a sexually liberated woman. Y'all know why men are scared of sexual women.
It's also particularly, like, damaging for Asian women, in the sense that what I know is that how the society has framed around the stereotype or stigma around the perception of Asian woman, you know, being submissive, obedient, docile, accommodating, you know, and also hyposexual, you know, in the media. There's actually a very, very damaging, like, and sexist idiom in Chinese, 上得了厅堂，下得了厨房，入得了闺房. You know, it literally means that a perfect woman should be able to enter the halls as elegantly as possible and create perfect food from the kitchen, as well as being hyposexual in the bedroom. So, like, in every aspect.
That's repulsive.
I think a lot of men are still following that kind of standard when you when they're, like, finding a partner. Oh, it's just really shallow. If you just look at how, like, I want to quickly mention, you know, how, as for the Asian diasporas in Western nations, you know, the also the colonialism impact of sexual influence. I was just reading an academic paper by this American Filipino woman, and she wrote, I'll link that show note into our show note. Here's what she said, that there's a something about brown skin, white mind does so impeccable job explaining how internalized racism and a common misinformed for the Western colonialization, you know, the colonial mentality is kind of transferred into a lot of, like, Asian immigrants, how we should teach them that white and Western is superior to our past culture.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and how, like, psychological framework for a lot of immigrants that say, like, the past or the older generations, they think that because the Western power is more superior, so we should, like, just follow what their media is portraying us, and it's kind of perpetuated and kind of doing a lot more damaging.
Yeah.
Like, now we're trying to flip the other side, saying that we want to create and also empower ourselves around the framework of how the West is seen Asian woman in the sense of, you know, like, sexual, like, the sexual representation.
Yeah.
You know, it's always very hypersexual.
Yeah.
Like, in the media and entertainment.
I feel, I'm listening to you say all these, and I'm loving everything you're saying, but I'm also kind of laughing, chuckling internally, because, you know, we have the shows like The Bachelor and The Bachelorette, and I think there have never actually even been one Asian woman. Like, we are hypersexualized, and yet we're not even considered by the broader Australian landscape as people who are worthy of love. Because that's ostensibly why women go on The Bachelor, because they want to say, hey, I'm eligible for this beautiful man. But like out of 114 women in the history of The Bachelor's seasons in Australia, I think 95 women have been white, and the others have been like darker skinned Indians, or like Indians who pass as white, like they're very beautiful or fair skinned Indians, like Anglo Indians. Yeah. But I think I'm pretty sure that we've had one or two Asians, but they've always been, you know, kicked out within the first or two rounds. But yeah, we're just like, we're hypersexualized, and yet we're not even considered as eligible romantic partners.
In saying that, I don't really watch Bachelor or Bachelorette, so I just think that they're...
Oh, the last time I watched it was like in 2017 at my friend's Christmas party. And it was like under the guise of a joke, but I think... who knows, right?
Yeah. I think we should be also like challenging the hegemonic, you know, how the West created narratives about Asian woman sexuality. I want to just bring up quickly about when I was doing the research for this part, like the Memoirs of Geisha. I've read this book so long ago, and also watched a movie.
Yeah.
And now I'm looking back, and like, I always know that it was written by a white Jew, but I never thought about how... I never really questioned the way that he presented the story about this geisha, and to now that we're, you know, questioning why, you know, we have to question why and how the West have portrayed like Asian woman and their idea around how we should represent ourselves. And I just think that it's just ridiculous. In saying that, I know that... I think I was just looking up at the Wikipedia. The writer, the author of the book, Arthur Gordon, he's actually... Arthur Gordon. Yeah. Oh. He was actually sued for breach of contract and defamation of character, the retired geisha, Iwasaki.
So he based it on a real person?
Yes, yeah.
I didn't know that. Wow.
And yeah, so apparently they agreed to protect her anonymous, you know, status if she told him about, you know, her life. And of course, due to like some kind of traditional code of silence about their client, he listed Iwasaki as the source of his acknowledgement. So she wasn't happy later that they had a settlement outside of the court, something like that. But apparently Iwasaki, the geisha, that she actually later went on to write an autobiography, which shows, it's indicated on Wiki saying that it's very different pictures of the 20th century geisha life than the one shown in Gordon's novel. So I would actually want to read that book, you know. It would be better actually through the lens of her own experience rather than maybe written by someone else. Yeah.
Absolutely. To finish things off, I wanted to ask a couple of last-minute questions. Helen, why do you think men don't feel sexy, or do they feel sexy? Because I have never heard a straight man talk about feeling sexy. And why is that?
I think because they hold more currency, sexual currency, I don't think it's like they don't need to, like they're the privileged group that they don't need to say, do anything to have, you know, woman to present themselves to them. I think that's one thing. And when you sent me the question, I was just thinking, okay, the first person I want to consider sexy, it's really hard because like on today's pod, we're just basically talking about a bit more physical, you know, the intimacy between physical bodies and things like that. But we haven't really covered the emotional intelligent levels, because you can be attracted, you can be sexually attracted by another person's intelligent, isn't it? I think there's a term for it.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, every time I say I like smart people, someone tells me, oh, you're a blah, 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 whatever that word is called. That term where you're only attracted to to intelligent people. I'm so fucking sick of that. I'm like, don't put me in a box. I'm attracted to, I'm not attracted to intelligence. I'm attracted to people who are cerebral. And that doesn't necessarily mean mm-hmm. intelligence. Mm-hmm. You know, intelligence is such a wide, expansive right. spectrum.
Yeah.
I think I know what you mean. What I find sexy is actually has nothing to do mm-hmm. with sex. What I find sexy is someone who's really original, who's someone really undiminished by the idea of being themselves. And someone who's sexy is someone who I want to get to know, not necessarily someone mm-hmm. I want to fuck. And the sexiest people are always the most courageous in the sense that they don't give a shit what people mm-hmm. think about them.
Yeah.
And they don't try to be likable. Mm-hmm.
They're just being themselves.
Yeah, like, yeah, for me, that's always been the benchmark for, like, the most appealing kind of person is someone who is like, fuck everything, fuck the world, and I'm going to think what I think, and that's all yeah. that matters. I yeah. love that. I think I love that. I don't know what to call it. It's just this kind of gravitas of, or this hubris that doesn't call on the approval of any other human being or group.
Yeah, definitely. I think you just have to be authentic, and connection with one another is, you know, not that easy nowadays. But in saying that, because we mentioned Demolition Man before, that, you know, about how sex will be becoming in the future, which yeah. is really interesting. And perhaps that, you know, people should start thinking about sex just not just only on physical levels. I think emotional intelligent levels is particularly important to be attracted sexually. Yeah.
Yeah. I think the reason, Helen, why I am so disinterested in sex now as someone in her early 30s is because I think back to all the sex I've had, and then I think back to all the conversations I've had with men, and often the most profound moments in my life have been deep, 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 genuine conversations where I felt heart-to-heart mm-hmm. connection with a man. And that has been something I haven't felt on an emotional level when I fuck someone. Like, for me, I value the emotional connection over the fucking. Yeah. That is why I think just I could be – I'm so happy to be celibate for the rest of my life. I remember telling this to a guy on a date a few weeks ago, and he just looked at me like I said I'm a Nazi lover. Yeah, he just gave me the weirdest look. He was like, oh, my God. Like, and I was like – and I felt judged. I felt judged by him because he made me feel like there was something wrong with me for not wanting to have sex for the rest of my life. But, like, I don't say that to, like, invite men to try and fuck me. I don't say that to try and lure people to try and fuck. I say that genuinely. I'm not interested in fucking. And it might change next week. Yeah. It might change tomorrow. It might change never. But, like, I have been thinking this for years that I am so happy to not ever fuck another man.
Yeah, of course. That's empowerment for you. You know, you get the choice and the decision is all within your hands. Yeah, that's empowerment for you. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I just – what I search for in life is not that kind of bodily connection. Mm-hmm. It's not corporeal connection. Mm-hmm. I search for something that's outside of the body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great. Okay, so now we're pleased to have Mary from Soy and Spice Lingerie collaborating with us for the very first time on our podcast as we discuss the topic of sexual empowerment. And I think I've either read or hear one of Mary's interview about her idea of starting a lingerie business for her intention to empower women and taking control of their own sexual identity. To me, you know, like when I was looking at her business name, the Soy is in the reference of comfortable, and how we Asians, you know, I don't know, I'm not sure about others, but at least this is how I perceive, you know, like soy milk, you know, the pureness and the health benefit of this item. As in for spice, I interpreted as an adventurous and gutsy experience one could take on. I quite like the concept of the combination of soy and spice, because as a woman, you know, comfort in my own body is the first step towards feeling empowered in a sexual way. And I think feeling content about myself is very important, and also the self-satisfactory in sexual experience. So here is a clip about Mary talking about how her experience and journey as an Asian entrepreneur in Australia, and how she began to work on Soy and Spice.
My name is Mary Lu, and I'm the founder of Soy and Spice Lingerie. I've been working on Sweet and Spice now for just under a year. But before this, I had spent the last 10 years of my career in the startup and entrepreneurial space. I actually started my entrepreneurial journey at the age of 19, where I had co-founded a charity with my best mate back in Adelaide. I grew up in Adelaide, and I think it would have been second year of university. Me and my best mate started a charity called M Squared. So the charity was essentially aimed at supporting underprivileged children in China and Sri Lanka. So what we used to do was we held donation events and people would come, and the proceeds would either go to an institution like an orphanage or go to a child in need directly. So we ran that charity for about 5 years. When I came to Sydney in 2012, we were still running the charity, but it got a little bit hard because we were in different states, and the logistics just got quite difficult to manage, so we ended up shutting it down. But when I came here to finish my final year in my bachelor's degree in psychology, I started another business called Ori, which was aimed at helping international students find work experience. So when I told my mom that I was going to drop my psych career to become an entrepreneur instead, she freaked out. She was like, are you crazy? Do you even know what you're doing? And, you know, when the news went out to the rest of my family, my aunties and uncles were always on my back and asking me what the hell is going on. Being raised in a single parent family with very traditional Chinese values, I was always taught to stick to what I know and not to take too many risks. But there was just something about entrepreneurship that I loved. It's a beautiful feeling to be able to turn an idea into a reality and people actually using it. It's actually quite magical. So since then, I've been a strong advocate in, you know, just keeping things a go. And pushing your boundaries and just trying new things out. And so I recently spent 4 years at UNSW Founders, which is the startup hub at the University of New South Wales, as a program manager. And so while I was there, I was essentially helping the student-led startups that came through our doors. So I was helping them with launching their businesses, coming up with growth strategies with them, and connecting them with the right people within the ecosystem to accelerate their growths. So while I was at UNSW Founders, I realized that the number of male students that came through our doors was far greater than the number of female students. So I went to my manager at the time, and I was like, hey, look, I want to do something about this. I want to do something about it now. And he was quite supportive of me. And so I started a program called New Wave Founders, which was aimed at tackling the specific problem. So the program was a 2-week long incubator program where we had invited 30 undergraduate female students to join us. And we went out and sourced different mentors and speakers to come and join the program as well. And at the end of the 2 weeks, the students would then pitch their ideas in front of a panel of judges, and they would be able to receive some sort of prize. So the program is actually still running today. And within 1 year of running the program while I was there, we actually managed to increase the number of female participation within entrepreneurship at UNSW by 13%, which is a pretty good number, actually. I left UNSW Founders at the beginning of last year. I've always been someone that's looking for new challenges. And after spending 4 years there, I felt like my time was up. I needed to go and try something new. So I went and tried corporate for a few months. I tried managing a startup hub in the city for a few months as well, but it just wasn't right for me. I've constantly thought about starting my own thing. And that's when I, you know, decided to make the leap of faith once again, to go back into entrepreneurship. So I've always had a love for lingerie. And when I wear it, I feel beautiful and I feel very confident. But when I talk to my girlfriends about it, hardly any of them wear it. So I really wanted to create a line of lingerie that they will feel comfortable in wearing, and create a brand that represents confidence, to love ourselves for who we are and to push our boundaries and give new things a go. And this could be wearing lingerie for the first time, or, you know, putting your hand up for a new project at work, or, you know, giving something that's completely outside of your comfort zone a go, like entrepreneurship, for example. the main obstacle for me, being an Asian woman entrepreneur, is the lack of representation in the media. You know, I feel like we see a lot of the Elon Musks, the Mark Zuckerbergs, but where are all the Asian entrepreneurs? Not just that, where are all the women Asian entrepreneurs? I feel like media plays such a huge part in our day-to-day lives, and especially as millennials. And that's why I really want to feature Asian lingerie models and just women across our community openly discussing about topics like beauty standards, for example, across all of our channels, to show that this is okay, that there's really nothing to be afraid of, that we can have an open and healthy discussion about topics like our sexuality, and we can and should be able to embrace our bodies just the way they are, and be able to express ourselves through lingerie and love it. So I've been working with a company based in Melbourne called Melbourne Fashion Labs on creating our first collection. So we'll be using natural materials because they are biodegradable at the end of their life. So I'm looking at organic cotton or organic bamboo, for example. However, it's quite unrealistic for lingerie line to be made out of completely 100% natural materials, because things like lace, straps, and the waistband are all synthetics. So in that case, we are looking at using recycled synthetics sourced from places like deadstock fabric waste, production trimmings, and vintage clothing, for example. So by using upcycled materials for these things, we are making sure that we use materials that's already in existence, and therefore giving them a better use than going to the landfill. I'm hoping to launch this collection by summer to spring next year. Fingers crossed if everything goes well. That's the plan. So I'm very, very excited for that. So the last question you asked me to kind of touch on is what I consider as sexy. I actually really love this question. And to me, I feel like what is sexy is being 100% comfortable with being you. You know, I feel like confidence is the most sexiest thing on earth. And so when you are 100% confident with being yourself, there's really nothing else like it. So that's what I think is the most sexiest.
So thank you so much, Mary from Soy and Spice, for coming to our pod to share her experience. For our first ever collaboration, we're holding a competition for our listeners to win a set of beautiful lingerie from Soy and Spice. So please check out our Instagram and Facebook once we have this episode on air, and follow the instructions to enter. Mary has also set up a discount code for our listeners to purchase their product. Upon checkout at their online store, enter the code hashtag AsianB. So it's hashtag capital ASIANB for a 10% discount. I'll link Soy and Spices, their website, on our social media platforms. The winner of the prize will be announced in 2 weeks' time. So I really encourage everyone to follow their page to stay up on date of the latest fashion and also the news from Soy and Spice. Okay, so it's coming to the end of our episode. Once again, thank you to our listeners. Remember to subscribe our podcast on Spotify, Google, and Apple Podcasts. Please give us a rating and review. You can also find us our update on Facebook and Instagram. Just search Asian Bitches Down Under. We welcome discussions and feedback. So we'll chat to you next week. Bye.